year is him restoring. He says, see that you make all things according to the pattern. We were given that pattern over in Exodus, exactly how to measure everything within us. Karen talked about us building a house. And in the Hebrews, he tells us, or I know it's Acts, he tells us that he will return to restore and rebuild his tabernacle. Well, he's not talking about a structure outside ourselves. He's talking about measuring and setting in order who we are inside that tabernacle that can flow as a body of believers, not just here, but all over this earth. And I know that takes some doing, but this is the year for it. I just want to read that scripture because I feel like it's for this day. In Acts 15:15, and to this agree the words of the prophets as it is written, after all of this, we're going through things every day. And you know, fairy tales always end and they lived happily ever after. Malarkey. There's so much more to be said in that happily ever after. You live life and you don't, and you tell of the beautiful moments that unfold in your life. So this isn't a fairy tale. This is a journey, beautiful journey. So he says, after this I will return and I will build again the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down. So how many people would you meet that had any idea the measurements of the tabernacle? And if they did, could they apply it to who they are inside? I mean, come on, folks. People don't even know that they're God's dwelling place. If we walk out of here, we take what God is with us. It's a people, and every man has that potential and the great ability within him to understand that and work on his house. God's building a house, and there's no hell in that house. But in my house, sometimes I bring a little bit of spicy flavor of hell along with me, right? We all do it. Of course we do. But it's not something that's going to stand. We know how to get rid of it. Hell is just the absence of God. John Morgan was here this week sharing with me, and someone had been afraid for him, and someone that loves him very much, and let him know he was going to go to hell. And I said, well, John Morgan, if there was such a place, maybe so. But how long? I mean, how long does it take you to burn up this everlasting hell? That is a ridiculous thought. I don't know how mankind got so carried away with that doctrine. I honestly do not know where it originated.
Fear.
In history, do you have any idea?
Well, it's a combination of things. The pagans believed in, they had hell, and they believed in it. But for them, it was a cyclic thing. They also believed in reincarnation. So what the church did was they took away the reincarnation, the possibility of redemption, and made it eternal.
Yes.
And so that they could subjugate people.
Oh, fear.
Use fear to make them kowtow and do what they wanted to. While meantime, they're having sex with young boys and whatever else they were doing. So, yeah.
Well, I know one time Don Cooley was teaching us, and most of you, all of you met Don Cooley, even him. Anyway, he said he was teaching, and a woman stood up and said, now, Don, you're not going to take my hell away. He said, oh, no, I wouldn't want to do that. You know, it was such a statement. It was a joke that was on her. You're not going to take my hell away. And he's going, oh no, I wouldn't want to do that. My goodness, folks. Anyway, I feel like Karen, that there is a newness and a change, and we kind of began with this as Terry and her were chit-chatting, and she said to Karen, there's something different. Well, yeah, there's something different every day. Every day is a new day. We can take it and really screw it up, or we can take it and make it a better day. Well, just ask, what is the first thing I need to change and do? Or do I just need to be still? Sometimes it's just be still and get through the phase or the moment.
Well, I think we forget that we're creators. The scripture says we are creators.
Yes.
So I don't think he meant buildings. I mean, obviously some people think that. But I think we get to, it's a choice. And it isn't somewhere off or outside of you. It's in this thing upside, right between your eyes.
Really?
And yeah. Often we're busy creating our own hell.
No kidding.
Rather than our heaven.
We like it, so we keep creating it.
Yeah. The most nefarious thing that the church system did was take away humanity's divinity.
Wow. That's true, Morgan. If we could get mankind, just people, you know, to see their worth, you know, so they don't have to continually validate themselves for being here. What is your worth? What's the next step in my life? I mean, God is so, so amazing. I was looking back over my life, and I'll do a quick recap if I can do such a thing. When I was 8 months old, there was a disease in South Carolina, and I guess it was nationwide, but it was called colitis. And I was in the hospital with it, and there was 5 babies in the hospital with it. 4 of them died. So my grandmother went home to pray, being Pentecostal, and she prayed out loud, I guess. So she went home to be in a quiet place to pray. And Aunt Mimi went with her, Aunt Mimi being mother's younger sister. And since I was the firstborn in all the families, the first child, grandchild, great-grandchild, blah, blah, I was important, I guess, to them for this baby to stay alive. And so grandmother went home to pray, and Aunt Mimi heard her praying, because she was praying out loud and saying, Father, you know what you have for Connie's life. If she's going to grow up and serve you, please let her live. But if she's not going to grow up and serve you and live a life of waste, then you just take her on. So she said, Aunt Mimi just had a fit. And Aunt Mimi told me, said, Mama, don't dare pray that way. You pray for Connie to live. And she said, oh no, children are on loan. She's not ours. So I cannot pray that way. She said, when they got back to the hospital, I was sitting up and eating. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of that story. And of course, I lived with her through my life. And last night, I was just kind of retracing some steps. You know how you do things you kind of forget or put way back in your memory. And we lived in Texas. Must have been about 12. And I was going to the store one morning. You just have to be in that little town to know how it's situated. But I stepped out of the house to go to the store, and a car was backing out of a place. I didn't see him, he didn't see me, because I was walking this way and he was behind me. So he backed into me and it knocked me down. And I remember seeing the back tire was about that far from my head when he stopped. And of course he jumped out, picked me up, took me home, and he was crying and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I could have been killed right there. Right after that, my grandmother made me a coat of many colors. She bought corduroy, and she was a great seamstress and put it together beautifully. And she told me the story, because you know the story, because I was raised in Pentecostal church, and the story of Joseph is huge anyway. So I didn't know the story. So I had a coat like Dolly of many colors that I was proud of my coat, though. Of course, it wasn't made out of rags. So if you've seen the coat of many colors, that really meant something to me, and I understood Dolly's story. So, you know, all of these things happening to me, I could have died any time. But God has a plan for fallen man. He lifts him up by his mighty hand. So we're never absent from the Father, whether we have a call on our life or we don't. And she would say that to me. Oh, you better be mindful, Connie. You belong to God. And you have a calling on your life. Well, boy, you really want to ignore that. I mean, when you're younger, you want to go, you know, I don't understand that, not really. But she made me understand it by teaching me daily. She talked to me about it. So here I am. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, Morgan.
Religion, we kind of, you know, we're talking about some of the things that people do in order to attempt to become more spiritual. And most of the time this takes the form of some sort of a ritual. Of course, that's just a vehicle to try to get us to a place spiritually where we're actually at rest, we're at one-ment, which is really what the word atonement means.
Yes.
It doesn't, you know, that's another thing they change, you know. At one-ment, which meant to be one with God, became atonement, which meant you had to do something to atone for your sin. So it was like taking what it meant and turning it on its head. It's the same thing with what we term is holy, H-O-L-Y, when it really just means to be whole.
Yes.
To be fully whole. So, and you know, that's what I was saying as far as the way the church does things. Get situated, everybody can see me. You know, they've, like I said, they basically stripped everybody from their divinity by obfuscating that fact, by saying, and I'll probably get some blowback on this, but by saying that Jesus is the Son of God and we ain't diddly squat. Now, it's clear if you really study that that's a misnomer. That's merely a doctrine. That's not what's in the Bible. You know, but that's what's been taught. So we kind of have to, it's almost like you have to disrobe yourself of all these things that you've been taught over the years that you thought were truth, but they're not. Until you get to the coat of many colors that is you.
Yes.
I'm going to read some of this because especially the first part is really beautiful. And
what are you reading, Morgan?
It's Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's not by experiencing or becoming one with divinity isn't something that you can get to or do by ritual. It's not even a thought. It's just a presence of being. It's the ability to understand where you've been, where you are, and where you're going, and accept it. You know, don't kick against the pricks.
Isn't it spontaneous though? Like our connection with other people, being able to recognize it's little things. Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's usually how, or one of the ways that we're able to experience divinity is through other folks.
Yeah.
You know, can I say something, son? Because I feel like when you opened and made your said what you said, you said that was not true. Well, some of that was truth, but it was partly truth, only part truth. That Jesus was the Son of God.
Omission on purpose is a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
kind of underline.
I'm just saying that so people don't get the idea that you do not believe there was a Jesus Christ or a Christ or a Jesus.
Sure,
amen.
I mean, I can flow with that. That's not a problem. But
because we don't want the We do need Jesus, especially what we call the Christ, and that gets into another teaching completely. So I do want you to go on, but I wanted to clarify that so everybody don't... Something in us want to get our hackles up when something controversial comes along, and so we lose what you're trying to
Well, the Christos for me is simply, it's another conduit to divinity. That's
absolutely
all. I mean, I'm going to start here. It says, the flowering of human consciousness, evocation. Earth, 114 million years ago, one morning, just after sunrise, the first flower ever to appear on the planet opens up to receive the rays of the sun. Prior to this momentous event that heralds an evolutionary transformation in the life of plants, the planet had been covered in vegetation for millions of years. The first flower probably did not survive for long, and flowers must have remained rare and isolated phenomena, since conditions were most likely not yet favorable for a widespread flowering to occur. One day, however, a critical threshold was reached, and suddenly there would have been an explosion of color and scent all over the planet, if a perceiving consciousness had been there to witness it. Much later, those delicate and fragrant beings we call flowers would come to play an essential part in the evolution of consciousness of another species. Humans would increasingly be drawn to and fascinated by them. As the consciousness of human beings developed, flowers were most likely the first thing that they came to value that had no utilitarian purpose for them. That is to say, it was not linked in some way to survival. They provided inspiration to countless artists, poets, and mystics. Jesus tells us to contemplate the flowers and learn from them how to live. The Buddha is said to have given a silent sermon once, in which he held up a flower and gazed at it. After a while, one of those present, a monk, began to smile. He is said to have been the only one who had understood the sermon. According to legend, that smile, or that is to say, realization, was handed down by 28 successive masters and much later became the origin of Zen. Seeing beauty in a flower could awaken humans, however briefly, to the beauty that is an essential part of their own innermost being, their true nature. The first recognition of beauty was one of the most significant events in the evolution of human consciousness. The feelings of joy and love are intrinsically connected to that recognition. Without ever fully realizing it, flowers would become for us an expression in form of that which is most high and most sacred, and ultimately formless within ourselves. Flowers, more fleeting, more ethereal, and more delicate than the plants out of which they emerged, would become like messengers from another realm, like a bridge between the world of physical forms and the formless. They not only had a scent that was delicate and pleasing to humans, but also brought a fragrance from the realm of spirit. Using the word enlightenment in a wider sense than the conventionally accepted one, we could look upon flowers as the enlightenment of plants. Any life form in any realm, mineral, vegetable, animal, human, can be said to undergo enlightenment. It is, however, an extremely rare occurrence since it is more than an evolutionary progression. It also implies a discontinuity in its development, a leap to an entirely different level of being, and most importantly, a lessening of materiality. What could be heavier and more impenetrable than a rock, the densest of all forms? And yet some rocks undergo a change in their molecular structure, turn into crystals, and so become transparent to the light. Some carbons, under inconceivable heat and pressure, turn into diamonds, and some heavy minerals into other precious stones. Most crawling reptilians, the most earthbound of all creatures, have remained unchanged for millions of years. Some, however, grew feathers and wings and turned into birds, thus defying the force of gravity that had held them for so long. They didn't become better at crawling or walking, but transcended crawling and walking entirely. Since time immemorial, flowers, crystals, precious stones, and birds have held a special significance for the human spirit. Like all life forms, they are, of course, temporary manifestations of the underlying one life, one consciousness. Their special significance and the reason why humans feel such a fascination for and affinity with them can be attributed to their ethereal quality. Once there is a certain degree of presence of still and alert attention in human beings' perceptions, they can sense the divine life essence, the one indwelling consciousness or spirit in every creature, every life form, and recognize it as one with their own essence, and so love it as themselves. Until this happens, however, most humans see only the outer forms, unaware of the inner essence, just as they are unaware of their own essence and identity, and identify only with their own physical and psychological form. In the case of a flower, a crystal, a precious stone, or a bird, however, even someone with little or no presence can occasionally sense that there is more than the mere physical existence of that form. Without knowing that this is the reason why he or she is drawn towards it and feels an affinity with it. Because of its ethereal nature, its form obscures the indwelling spirit to a lesser degree than is the case with other life forms. The exception to this are all newborn life forms, babies, puppies, kittens, lambs, and so on. They are fragile, delicate, not yet established in materiality. A sweetness and beauty that are not of this world will shine through them. They delight even relatively insensitive humans. So when you're alert and contemplate a flower, a crystal, a bird, without naming it mentally, it becomes a window for you into the formless. There is an inner opening, however slight, into the realms of the spirit. This is why these three enlightened life forms have played such an important part in the evolution of human consciousness since the ancient times. Why, for example, the jewel in the lotus flower is a central symbol of Buddhism, and a white bird, the dove, signifies the Holy Spirit in Christianity. They have been preparing the ground for a more profound shift in planetary consciousness that is destined to take place in the human species. This is the spiritual awakening that we are beginning to witness now. And I think everybody can agree that that's true. More and more people are getting rid of those old doctrines and dogmas that are no longer serving mankind anymore, and looking individually for more truth, becoming less of a religious sheeple and, you know, more of a spiritual hunting lion, looking for some truth.
That was well put. What you just said about the spiritual hunting line, see, that points right to Jesus Christ and the building of the tabernacle, the priest, and all those things. And I think it's very interesting that the Islamic teachings and their ideas of being backward and living in the Middle Ages is so blatantly out there now, because it is being dealt with. I think that's awesome, although they're doing some terrible things, killings and, you know, the atrocities. We would all agree in this room about all of that. But I feel that in God's plan, He's using this.
Well, for the first time,
all of us to see.
Yeah, for the first time in probably at least 10,000, maybe 12,000 years, as long as we know of recorded history, put it that way, all the other religions, world religions, really have kind of embraced the idea of oneness, you know, as it should be.
Absolutely. You know,
because one person's spiritual walk is not your walk. And don't you dare judge them.
Really?
Don't you dare. You have no damn right.
But we do it.
Well, you do it, but that's at your own peril.
I have such a strong urge. We were talking about creation. Basically, that's what you're talking about. Okay, the creation there part, that's within us. Okay, that's how it starts.
Well, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't know if anybody gets that part. But when you were saying that, I'm looking at this. It all originates back to nature, animals.
Sure.
Okay, and I think people just miss that concept. It's right here in front of us, folks. I mean, it's right, it's in the stars.
It says it in the...
God did this.
It says it in the Bible, and the Quran, and in...
Over and over again, it's in front of us.
Well, it's a great awareness for you right now.
Not just that, the nature part. Really
proven.
Honey,
I hear you.
If you want to know how divinity works, just
get out there and
take a look outside.
Well, it's the seed in the earth.
Yes,
that's
to me,
right.
That's what that is.
But they're even proving that blood pressure gets lowered, the stress is lesser. I mean, if you just get in touch, go out in the woods, sit on the ground, and just meditate. I'm not now, it's cold. But I have done it. I have done it barefoot because Margaret suggested it one time. Take your shoes off, go out there, sit in them leaves, and just be quiet. And well, you'd be amazed.
That's an Indian teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Indians do that.
But I've been watching lately the Geo Channel, and scientists are on there, and they're proving that over and over and over again that people light up when they hug a tree, or if you make the suggestion, it sounds absurd. It does sound absurd to us, to some people, but this guy did it, and he did what was suggested, and there was such a release, just taking his hands and letting him be in the water, being still.
Well, the light, too, of water molecules as well.
I just think there's something to be said about it that we've missed, that we keep missing, and we're not getting it.
And this is the problem that we're encountering with Islam. The rest of the world is moving on, and they're not.
Right.
And they feel threatened, maybe. As they should.
Yeah, they do.
Because it's they're either going to have to adapt or die off or be eradicated, because the rest of the world is not going to put up with it.
Well, yeah, it's time for a showdown.
It's time for a flow, work out your ways.
I feel like it's time for the pouring out of God's Spirit on all
mankind,
including Islam.
It's interesting to watch, what happened with Iran yesterday, the hostages being released and the sanctions being lifted. So they had a program on Anthony Bodine last night, where he had gone to Iran. And what stood out to me in the program was that 60% of Iranians are under the age of 30. Now, these are the next generation. That's big. And they're wearing the hijab. They wear it. But they wear it in colors, and they wear it way back from their face, and their hair shows. Just about all of them. And it's maybe some of the older women had on the black, but they still didn't cover their faces completely.
This is, that's a geopolitical issue between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They are diametrically opposed to each other. It's like the Catholic Church and the Protestants. So it's the same thing.
It's the same thing, it is.
All right, and they're dragging the entire world into this conflict. Yeah, so
It's the young people coming up, though, I think.
Well, they have,
Interesting, the population being so huge of those that are under 30, and these people will have a voice.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
They'll have a voice.
So, perhaps things will change.
Well, every knee will bow and every tongue confess before it's over.
That's right.
I don't know how long it's going to be before it's over.
It won't be over in our lifetime, but it will be over.
Perhaps,
but there's
not
a great beginning.
Well, it could.
And we are at the beginning of the launching of this beautiful thing that we're seeing. It's horrible, but it's beautiful. Because it's going to be done with. And I'm like Karen, I probably won't see the outcome of it. But we're seeing it blatantly for the first time. It's on the news every day. You can't help but look at it. So it's having to be dealt with. I think that's so spiritual in each one of us. If, as we grow, whether we want to or not, things come that need to be dealt with, are time for us to see an awakening. And we cannot stop that. That's part of our spiritual evolution.
I think that, every religion, Islam included, has beauty and truth in it. It's a matter of what is it that you're looking for? What are you trying to hunt and peck for? Are you wanting the little rocks, or are you actually wanting some food? So, anyway.
First the natural, then the spiritual. So, we will observe this in the natural, just like transgender going on right now. But, it's this idea of the feminine and the masculine within us. We have that going on within us. We are male and female. Mm-hmm. And so it's being projected out there in the natural.
Yes, it is.
What is really going on in the spirit within us, if we could see that.
Sure. Yeah, I don't even give a second thought.
It's
their life, their business.
Coming from the generation that I come from, it's
bizarre.
I really have struggled with it.
Really?
So, I mean, you know, it's not that I don't love the person. I mean, you know, I do think I can make that distinction within me, because when I went into the military, I got around some gay people, and I actually ended up really liking them. You know, their feminine side to them.
Yes.
Was more evident, and I like that they could show that feminine side, yes. Which men have trouble doing that. And you didn't feel this conflict, this sexual kind of tension going on with him either, which is kind of new, you know, was a new feeling for
refreshing.
Me.
Refreshing.
Yeah. So, I mean, but for me, it's, I think that I can distinguish. I can say, well, I don't like the action, but, you know, I can still love that person. You know, I think I can personally distinguish that as long as they're treating people right, you know, in that. But it's a change for me to see that, and when you watch movies and so on, more and more of this going on, it's like I really struggle with it.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we do this generation. It's easier for Morgans and Michael
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
this generation, and then these kids' generations to receive certain things. Because it's like turning us inside out. And
it goes against everything we've ever been taught. You know, mm-hmm. we really have
yeah, really.
Either.
Well, there again, that goes back to what Morgan was teaching earlier about what the scripture, what that we've been taught so many things from the time we were little. You know, I've always said the white picket fence and the Cinderella syndrome, it's all bull, okay? It's complete bull.
It's
but
not
y'all had that.
But we hold that
in
ideal.
Our generation,
yeah.
that didn't happen. Okay, mm-hmm. It's just not.
Right.
Well, they say Cinderella syndrome is good because it gives you hope.
Well, I've been hoping for 58 years.
Okay, let's move on.
It's okay to dream. You know, may not ever come to reality.
On. Morgan wants to move on.
All right.
Let's move on.
Is humanity ready for a transformation of consciousness? An inner flowering so radical and profound that compared to it, the flowering of plants, no matter how beautiful, is only a pale reflection. Can human beings lose the density of their conditioned mind structures and become like crystals, or precious stones, so to speak, transparent to the light of consciousness? Can they defy the gravitational pull of materialism and rise above the identification that keeps the ego in place and condemns them to imprisonment within their own personality? The possibility of such a transformation has been the central message of the great wisdom teachings of humankind. The messengers, Buddha, Jesus, and others, not all of them known, were humanity's early flowers. They were precursors, rare and precious beings. A widespread flowering was not yet possible at that time, and their message became largely misunderstood and often greatly distorted. It certainly did not transform human behavior, except in a small minority of people. Is humanity more ready now than at the time of those early teachers? And why should this be so? What can you do, if anything, to bring about or accelerate this inner shift? What is it that characterizes the old egoic state of consciousness? And by what signs is the new emerging consciousness recognized? These and other essential questions will be addressed. More important, this book itself is a transformational device that has come out of the arising new consciousness. The ideas and concepts presented here may be important, but they are secondary. They are no more than signposts pointing toward awakening. As you read, a shift takes place within you. The book's main purpose is not to add new information or beliefs to your mind or to try to convince you of anything. but to bring about a shift in consciousness, that is to say, awaken. In that sense, this book is not interesting. Interesting means that you can keep your distance, play around with ideas and concepts in your mind, agree or disagree. This book is about you. It will change your state of consciousness, or it will be meaningless. It can only awaken those that are ready. Not everyone is ready yet, but many are. And with each person who awakens, the momentum in the collective consciousness grows and becomes easier for the others. If you don't know what awakening means, read on. Only by awakening can you know the true meaning of that word. A glimpse is enough to initiate the awakening process, which is irreversible. For some, that glimpse will come while reading this book. For many others, who may not even have realized it, the process has already begun. This book will help them recognize it. For some, it may have begun through the loss or suffering, and for others, through coming into contact with a spiritual teacher or teaching, through reading The Power of Now or some other spiritually alive and therefore transformational book, or any combination of the above. If the awakening process has begun in you, the reading of this book will accelerate and intensify it. An essential part of the awakening is the recognition of the unawakened you. The ego as it thinks, speaks, and acts, as well as the recognition of the collectively conditioned mental processes that perpetuate the unawakened state. That is why this book shows the main aspects of the ego and how they operate in the individual as well as in the collective. This is important for two related reasons. The first is that unless you know the basic mechanics behind the workings of the ego, you won't recognize it, and it will trick you into identifying with it again and again.
Absolutely, it does.
This means it takes you over, an imposter pretending to be you. The second reason is that the act of recognition itself is one of the ways in which awakening happens. When you recognize the unconsciousness in you, that which makes the recognition possible is the arising consciousness, is awakening. You cannot fight against the ego and win, just as you cannot fight against darkness. The light of consciousness is all that is necessary, and you are that light. You know, no matter how black, pitch black a place is, you can light a single candle flame and it'll banish the darkness.
Absolutely. I've been in a situation like that. I think I was the only one who had a candle.
our inherited dysfunction.
You had that.
Next section is called Our Inherited Dysfunction. If we look more deeply into humanity's
may I interrupt a second?
Sure.
Well, this is just interesting, I think, that you talking about the consciousness, you know, awakening to the consciousness of Him within us, that we are asleep. Because I was reading about that this morning in First Thessalonians, that very thing about us being asleep. Now, there are those who sleep in Christ. Now, they're not talking about a death. They're talking about those that have come to a knowledge of Him, but yet went asleep. They're asleep in that. Their consciousness has not been awakened. But He said But ye brethren are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief, because He comes as a thief in the night.
Yes.
So, we are children of the light and the children of the day, and we're not of the night, nor of the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Let us not sleep. He's talking about those that have come to a knowledge of Him, but yet went asleep in that knowledge. He's not talking about a physical death here.
He's talking about knowledge.
Sleeping in that consciousness, that we need to awaken our consciousness. We are children of the light, so they just went to sleep in that knowledge.
And stayed on a realm.
And stayed there in that realm. Yeah.
That makes me want to challenge something Morgan read, and I wrote it down because it was profound to me. The awakening process, Toei said, is irreversible.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we talk about that a few minutes? Because
that was pretty profound, too. I caught that.
You just proved that.
Well, he said irreversible. He didn't say progressive. You could start it and never
really do much with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, anybody has their own journey. I mean, just because it starts doesn't mean it's
irreversible.
It's irreversible, but doesn't mean it's
progressive. Well, I'm an Aries, so everything's a catalyst for me. Catapult.
Well, not everybody.
The catalyst is just something that starts a chemical reaction. It doesn't mean it carries it all the way through. Once you start the awakening process, everybody has their own journey. Like you said, it doesn't mean that once it starts, well, you're just on a rocket ship out to space.
No.
Not everybody's
Aries. It just means you're on the launching pad.
Well, that's an Aries thing, so I need a lever to straighten me out back here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That's good.
But I just wanted to challenge that because I like Toei, but I see holes.
Yes.
Somewhere.
Yes.
I don't really see any.
And it's good for the recording. It's to make those clarifications, I think. So we can,
well, we're enjoying what we're doing.
Yeah. But I'm saying those that here.
As long as the loaves and fishes are feeding us, that's what I'm going to give you. So.
But it's interesting that they would come to, he talked often about that, Paul, those that came to a knowledge of him and forsake it, really, went to sleep in it.
Well, that's what religion does, okay?
Yeah.
That is, if you stay within a religious system, you're going to top out and you're not going to go any further. I mean, it's the function of it. That's what it does. It means to bind. That's what religion
means. If you've aligned yourself with the religion or the ritual
rather than
a relationship with that one.
Exactly.
You know, yes.
So you're serving... Mm-hmm. You're serving a man.
How are you serving?
You're
yes.
serving a man-made construct, not yourself
concept,
or the divinity
yes.
within you.
Yes.
So.
It's like a drug addict.
Yeah.
You keep taking that drug.
Well, it's like a crazy person.
You
keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
Really.
But what you're saying is that then that drug is then controlling you. It's the drug itself. But the experience of the drug that you're looking for, you know, we're looking for an experience with Christ.
Yes.
Not with the drug. with him himself. You know, but yet they go back to the drug.
I'm looking
that
for an
experience
with the divinity that is mine.
Yeah,
that is,
well, that's what she's saying.
That's what I'm saying.
But yeah, most people
find that individually.
We do have to.
Yeah. Most people nowadays don't want to do that because they're afraid of that divinity that's inside them. They don't know what it is. They can feel it when they're around other people. They share experiences, but apart from that, they
finding it for themselves. Yes.
Finding it for themselves,
yes.
And it's like really getting to know who you are. Some people are afraid of it. Some people just want to jump into it.
Yeah, that's good.
I think that's beautiful.
That's good, Garrett.
But there's a step beyond just that. There's putting it in shoe leather, in your feet. That has to be done. We can talk about it, do everything,
well,
but we have
this
to.
This age is not about
it.
That. I'm going to say that one more time. This age is not about that.
I understand. So.
This age is about
the work of it.
Starting that. Well, first of all, we got to get rid of all the old junk, all the skeletons that are in our closet.
Yeah.
You know, all the stuff that is holding us back, all the bad doctrines and
all the guilt,
dogmas,
all the...
and we got to get rid of all that junk first,
baggage.
So that we can be filled like the, you know, the Aquarian man is filling the mouth of the fish, so that we can receive the knowledge. You know, you can't stuff 15 pounds of garbage in a 5-pound sack. It doesn't work. Well, so here, we have to divest ourselves of some of this junk that we have.
Well, Morgan, yeah, but people talk about we need to get rid of our garbage, we need to get rid of our baggage, we need to do the work, and then we can embrace Him, and we can take on the divinity that's already actually there. But what I think that we get that backwards. We need to embrace His divinity, and all the rest of that garbage actually, would just fall away.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it works together. As you encounter one thing, it gets rid of.
But we don't need to go after that as if it's our enemy. That's all I'm saying. I'm going to make that.
Well, I'm not going to tell anybody how to do it.
You know, because what I'm saying is, we can't make that our enemy because that just gives it more power. So we just
It's like the war on drugs.
You know, not say, okay, that's a bad thing that I got going on, and I'm going after that bad thing. Well, the more you go after that thing. The more it's going to hit you in the face as you go after it.
It's because you're working against yourself, you know.
Really?
I guess it was Joseph Campbell, he said, well, you know, if you have a character flaw, or what people say is a character flaw, like, you know, let's say you're stubborn, well, find a way to make it work for you instead of against you.
Yeah, can it be your strength, too, not just your weakness? Yeah.
Make whatever your ego is subservient.
Yeah.
Not in charge of everything.
Exactly.
That happens.
What's controlling you? Are you controlling it?
Right. Yeah. Let me just get through this next section and we'll stop because it's getting late.
Fine. You want us to keep quiet? Okay.
No, you're fine.
The Pope sees in the talk, so you better.
Yeah. If we look more deeply. Oh, I already started reading that. Yeah, I started it. Okay. If we look more deeply into humanity's ancient religions and spiritual traditions, we will find that underneath the many surface differences, there are two core insights that most of them agree on. The words that they use to describe those insights differ, yet they all point to a twofold fundamental truth. The first part of this truth is the realization that the normal state of mind of most human beings contains a strong element of what we might call dysfunction or even madness. Certain teachings at the heart of Hinduism perhaps come the closest to seeing this dysfunction as a form of collective mental illness. They call it Maya, the veil of delusion. One of the greatest Indian sages bluntly states, the mind is Maya. Maya means illusion. Buddhism uses different terms. According to the Buddha, the mind, human mind in its normal state generates, I don't know how to say that, dukkha, which can be translated as suffering, unsatisfactoriness, or just plain misery. He sees it as a characteristic of the human condition. Wherever you go, whatever you do, says the Buddha, you will encounter it, and it will manifest in every situation sooner or later. According to Christian traditions, the normal collective state of humanity is one of original sin. Sin is a word that has been greatly misunderstood and misinterpreted, literally translated from the ancient Greek, in which the New Testament is written, to sin means to miss the mark. As an archer who misses a target, so to sin means to miss the point of human existence. It means to live unskillfully, blindly, and thus to suffer and cause suffering. Again, the term, stripped of its original cultural baggage and misinterpretations, points to the dysfunction inherent in the human condition. The achievements of humanity are impressive and undeniable. They have created sublime works of music, literature, painting, architecture, and sculpture. More recently, science and technology have brought about radical change in the way that we live and have enabled us to do and create things that would have been considered miraculous even 200 years ago. No doubt, the human mind is highly intelligent. Its very intelligence is tainted by madness. Science and technology have magnified the destructive impact of the dysfunction of the human mind has upon the plant, other life forms, and upon humans themselves. This is why the history of the 20th century is where that dysfunction, that collective insanity, can be most clearly recognized. A further factor is that this dysfunction is actually intensifying and accelerating. The First World War broke out in 1914. Destructive and cruel wars, motivated by fear, greed, and the desire for power, had been common occurrences throughout human history, as had slavery, torture, and widespread violence inflicted for religious and ideological reasons. Humans suffered more at the hands of each other than through natural disasters. By the year 1914, however, the highly intelligent human mind had invented not only the internal combustion engine, but also bombs, machine guns, submarines, flamethrowers, and poison gas. Intelligence in the service of madness. In the static trench warfare in France and Belgium, millions of men perished to gain a few miles of mud. When the war was over in 1918, the survivors looked in horror and incomprehension upon the devastation left behind. 10 million human beings killed, and many more maimed or disfigured. Never before had human madness been so destructive in its effect, so clearly visible. And little did they know that this was only the beginning. By the end of the century, the number of people who died a violent death at the hand of their fellow humans would rise to more than 100 million. They died not only through wars between nations, but also through mass exterminations and genocide, such as the murder of 20 million class enemy spies and traitors in the Soviet Union under Stalin, or the unspeakable horrors of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany. They also died in countless smaller internal conflicts, such as the Spanish Civil War, or during the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia, when a quarter of that country's population was murdered. We only need to watch the daily news on television to realize that the madness has not abated, that it is continuing into the 21st century. Another aspect of the collective dysfunction of the human mind is the unprecedented violence that humans are inflicting on other life forms and the planet itself. The destruction of oxygen-producing forests and other plant and animal life, ill-treatment of animals in factory farms, poisoning of rivers, oceans, and the air, driven by greed, ignorant of their connectedness to the whole, humans persist in that behavior. If continued unchecked, can only result in their own destruction. The collective manifestations of the insanity that lies at the heart of the human condition constitute the greater part of human history. It is to a large extent a history of madness. If the history of humanity were the clinical case history of a single human being, the diagnosis would have to be chronic paranoid delusions and pathological propensity to commit murder and acts of extreme violence and cruelty against his perceived enemies. His own unconsciousness projected outward, criminally insane, with a few brief lucid intervals. Fear, greed, and desire for power are the psychological motivating forces not only behind warfare and violence between nations, tribes, religions, and ideologies, but also the cause of incessant conflict in personal relationships. They bring about a distortion in your perception of other people and yourself. Through them, you misinterpret every situation, leading to a misguided action designed to rid you of fear and satisfy your need for more, a bottomless hole that can never be filled. It is important to realize, however, that fear, greed, and desire for power are not the dysfunction that we are speaking of, but are themselves created by the dysfunction, which is a deep-seated collective delusion that lies within the mind of each human being. A number of spiritual teachings tell us to let go of fear and desire, but those spiritual practices are usually unsuccessful. They haven't gone to the root of the dysfunction. Fear, greed, and desire for power are not the ultimate causal factors. Trying to become a good or better human being sounds like a commendable and high-minded thing to do, yet it is an endeavor you cannot ultimately succeed in unless there is a shift in consciousness. That is because it is still part of the same dysfunction, a more subtle and rarefied form of self-enhancement or desire for more, and a strengthening of one's conceptual identity, one's self-image. You do not become good by trying to be good, but by finding the goodness that is already within you and allowing that goodness to emerge. But it can only emerge if something fundamental changes in your own state of consciousness. The history of communism, originally inspired by noble ideas, clearly illustrates what happens when people attempt to change external reality, create a new earth, without any prior change in their inner reality, state of consciousness. They make plans without taking into account the blueprint for dysfunction that every human being carries within. The ego.
Yeah.
Well, that's beautiful, and I want to say this real quick, because the intellect has to do with the tribe of Dan, and we could teach on Dan for 10 years and all their ills, you know. They are the ones that, where the intellect stemmed, or they carried the intellect. And the very first thing that Christ tells us in throughout the scripture, but especially in the New Testament, he says, let any kind of judgment you have begin within you. It be dealt with as you. Well, people, we don't do that, or I do that some, but anyway, so judgment has to begin in your own dysfunctional thinking. But that's why Dan will not be chosen, hasn't been chosen to be a part. That is Scorpio, by the way, which is September 21st to October 21st. That will not be located in the tribes at all, because Libra will take its place. I picture in the, up there, but the priesthood tribe camps within the camp in front of all of the tribes, the four priesthood tribes, which was Aaron and Miriam and Gershom and what's the other one? The four. Anyway, they move out and become a tribe of their own, Levi, which is Libra, and Scorpio is completely not even there. The tribe of Dan is annihilated, so to speak.
The judgment gets weak.
And it's dispersed throughout the rest of the tribes. So that's what I'm saying. We are getting ready in Aquarius for, just like you said, the next age. You better get ready in Aquarius, because when you deal in Capricorn, it's going to be in your feet or you're dead. You won't be part of it. Because,
well,
that's how it works.
You know, everything is I mean, it's, I think it's been pretty clearly illustrated, is a progression.
Good grief,
now,
yes.
You know, does that mean that, you know, we get to Capricorn and everybody's gotten their feet and everything's perfect and wonderful?
No.
No.
Oh, no,
no,
son, I know better.
You know, the ego is not going to be truly dealt with until then.
Yes.
And the problem that that Capricorns have,
yeah,
is that.
It's self-righteousness.
It's self-righteousness.
And their emotional coldness.
Yeah.
Because they're emotionally.
So, you know, each thing has its own little hurdle to overcome, so to speak.
But the children of the light are like the watchmen on the wall.
Yes.
And so what she's saying is we need to look ahead beyond the circumstances,
yes,
that we are in. Okay, and that's that hope that maketh us not ashamed.
Absolutely.
And
actually,
the priests are the ones, when they crossed over the Jordan, the priests are the ones carrying the Ark of the Covenant, who put their feet in the water, and then the water was
dried
stopped
up
right there in a heap. all the way back to Adam,
to the city
way,
of Adam.
All the way back to the city of Adam, so that the children of Israel could cross over. So the priests put their feet in the water, so the Levites, you know, that replacement of the tribe of Dan of judgment, we have to be as priests.
Yes.
You know, the children of the light are as priests.
I think many will be.
There's some controversy now going on about where they crossed over at.
Well, let's not get into all that right now.
I'm just saying.
It's late.
Yeah.
I'm going to wrap it up.
I'm surprised Michael ain't.
We can talk more.
You guys aren't ready for the land.
There's that ego.
Is he going to whack us?
The eagle will always be with us, just like the pork. You know,
yeah.
we're not going to destroy the eagle, but we can
overcome.
We need a little bit of balance, Aaron. We can control it and get it under our feet. You know.
You want to see a balance? Look at that.
It'll be the
constellation.
It'll
this
become
is the balance
a seraphim.
Here. The balance.
It'll, be what?
It'll become a seraphim.
Come on, Michael.
I just wanted to remind you of one thing. Jesus.